This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 15th of April, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. As the battle in Libya rages on, NATO airstrikes continue, but the alliance fails to get more members to participate. The International Criminal Court delivers a war crimes conviction in the trial of a Croatian general regarded by his supporters as a hero.
My vision of Gotovina was all the time nice person, honest person, did nothing wrong to anyone.
And in the United States, growing concerns about the impact of gas drilling on public health and the environment.
There's a lot of Texas license plates around, a lot of people coming in from out of the area to take jobs where they have the training and the skills that we don't have here.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In India, a physician and civil rights activist has once again been granted bail and released from prison. Dr. Binyak Sen is internationally revered for his work with the poor. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal has the latest.
In December, a court sentenced Dr. Binyak Sen to life in prison for sedition and having links to Maoist militants seeking to overthrow the Indian government. But now, Supreme Court says there is not enough evidence to prove Dr. Sen is guilty of sedition. It said the mere possession of Maoist literature does not make someone a Maoist. The granting of bail does not overturn the conviction. That will have to be decided by the lower courts. But still, Dr. Sen's wife, Elena, says she feels extremely relieved about the judgment.
The appeal will continue and the legal process will continue to plague us for some more time. But the fact that this particular phase of the nightmare is over.
Dr. Sen's arrest drew international condemnation, grabbing the attention of 22 Nobel laureates who appealed for his immediate release. Jasvinder Sehgal, FSRN, India.
An Italian activist with ties to Palestinian solidarity movements was found dead this morning in Gaza. A little-known Islamist group has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping and murder of Vittorio Arrigoni. Police discover the body in an abandoned apartment in northern Gaza. It's the first abduction of a foreigner in Gaza since Hamas took power 4 years ago. FSRN's Rami Omagari has more.
Hundreds of demonstrators gathered on a Friday afternoon in front of UN offices in Gaza City, condemning the murder of Vittorio Arrigoni and demanding justice. Arrigoni had been based in Gaza since 2008 after arriving on the Free Gaza Solidarity boat. He regularly participated in protests against the Israeli occupation and helped farmers harvest their crops in dangerous areas along the border. An Islamist Salafi group calling itself Hammam ibn Maslama announced the kidnapping on Thursday, giving Hamas 30 hours to release the group's members from prison. But police discovered the body long before the deadline was up. Hamas denounced the killing. Spokesperson Dr. Sami Abu Zuhri tied the murder to efforts to disrupt international aid to the territory.
Such a crime is obviously aimed at towing down solidarity ships that are expected to dock in Gaza soon. Therefore, we call on the international solidarity movement to dispatch the largest convoy yet to Gaza.
Hamas has vowed to severely punish those responsible. Rami Al-Mighari, FSRN, Gaza.
In Nigeria, Muslims and Christians are engaged in a political struggle similar to neighboring Ivory Coast. Tomorrow, the intensity of that struggle will be tested as Nigerians go to the polls to choose a president. Elections in Africa's most populous country are often characterized by violence and voting fraud. FSRN's Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Three opposition candidates from the Muslim North are challenging incumbent president Goodluck Jonathan, who is from the Christian South. But because of the split Muslim vote, Jonathan is considered the front runner. Religious differences in Nigeria have fueled conflicts for nearly half a century. In the past 12 years, 14,000 people have died in clashes. The presidential election presents a high potential for renewed religious violence. Whoever wins Saturday's election will be left with the difficult challenges facing Nigeria's oil industry, which accounts for 90% of export earnings. the new president will face anger in the Niger Delta region, where local people are demanding a share of oil proceeds. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Georgia lawmakers approved a bill late last night that empowers a state and local crackdown on illegal immigration. It's similar to the controversial law passed in Arizona 1 year ago. For FSRN, Kajusa Cesar reports from Atlanta.
About 200 people rallied outside the state capitol last night to protest House Bill 87, according to Asadeh Shashahani of the American Civil Liberties Union. She said the ACLU has collected more than 20,000 signatures urging Governor Nathan Deal to veto the bill. Opponents, such as the Georgia Farm Bureau, argue that it ties up businesses in red tape, deters migrant farm laborers, and could lead to racial profiling. But passing Arizona-style immigration laws was one of Governor Deal's campaign promises last year. The Georgia version requires businesses with more than 10 employees to check the citizenship status of new hires using the federal E-Verify program. It also empowers local and state police to arrest and jail a suspect without citizenship papers, for example, during a traffic stop. And it establishes a 7-member board to investigate any officials who fail to enforce the law. Kitusa Cesar, FSRN, Atlanta.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Libya, NATO airstrikes continue. Reports say aircraft have bombed the cities of Azizaya and Sirte, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's birthplace. Meanwhile, pro-Gaddafi forces have fired rockets at the city of Misrata, the only major rebel stronghold in the west of the country. In Berlin, a 2-day NATO conference finished with the alliance unable to get commitments from more members to supply aircraft to help with the airstrikes. NATO Secretary-General Anders Rasmussen said NATO was absolutely determined to continue its operation.
Overall, our commanders do have the assets they need, but they also request a number of precision fighter aircrafts.
In an open letter published in multiple media outlets, President Barack Obama, British Prime Minister David Cameron, and French President Nicolas Sarkozy said it was their duty and mandate under UN Security Council Resolution 1973 to continue military operations to protect civilians. The leaders added that while the mandate is not to remove Gaddafi by force, it is impossible to imagine a future for Libya with him in power. But Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said today NATO's military operations had already exceeded their mandate. The war in Libya has led to a massive humanitarian crisis for the hundreds of thousands of people who've fled the country. Today, some migrants left Misrata on a ship, but their final destination is far from certain as refugee camps become overcrowded. UN Radio's Julie Walker reports.
Nearly 1,200 migrants who were stranded in Misrata since the start of the Libyan crisis 2 months ago were rescued Friday. The International Organization for Migration was able to get a chartered ship into the port city where Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's forces have been bombing. IOM spokeswoman Jamini Panja says the rescued migrants were living under deplorable conditions.
The priority really is, for us anyway, is saving the lives of the migrants who are in an extremely, extremely bad condition. They have not had food for a very long time, no clean water, in poor medical health, dehydrated.
The ship had also brought aid to Misrata in the form of food, water, and medical supplies. Panja says there are at least 8,000 more migrants from several African countries waiting around the docks in the hopes of leaving. But IOM does not have the money to get them all out.
We simply do not have money to carry out such life-saving operations. We are again about on Monday to go into a very low operational mode because money has run out.
The UN had called for $310 million but has received less than half. The UN's refugee agency says it's facing a critical shortage of funds for operations in Libya and neighboring countries. Spokesman Andrei Mihecic says UNHCR needs at least $30 million.
Throughout Libya, UNHCR has identified a need to expand activities to provide assistance to tens of thousands of displaced people and thousands of refugees who depend upon us for help.
The European Union is working out plans for a military force to guard humanitarian operations in Libya. But Elizabeth Beers of the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that's only a last resort. She believes aid agencies should remain neutral.
More and more relief activities are going on without military escorts, and we would like to continue to explore this option before invoking any military support. As I said, this is the last resort. We are monitoring the situation should any other means be needed.
According to the UN, 500,000 people have left Libya since the conflict began in February, while hundreds of thousands more are still stranded in the country. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he feared up to 3.6 million people, that's half the Libyan population, could need humanitarian assistance. Julie Walker, United Nations.
An international tribunal today convicted former Croatian army officer Ante Gotovina for crimes committed during the war in the former Yugoslavia, including participating in a joint criminal enterprise to persecute Serbian civilians. Hermione G. reports from The Hague.
Gotovina didn't flinch as presiding judge Alphonse Ori read the verdict, finding the former Croatian general guilty on 8 out of 9 charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. But his supporters in the public gallery gasped audibly as Ori passed down a sentence of 24 years. And one man cried openly as the judge concluded the proceedings. For them and for many people in Croatia, Gotovina is a hero, the man who helped liberate Croatia from Serb control. Mario Filippi served with Gotovina during the Balkans War. He spent 4 days driving to The Hague from his home in Croatia to attend the verdict.
It's like a fairy tale, ugly fairy tale. My vision of Gotovina was all the time nice person, honest person, did nothing wrong to anyone. But crime for such person, it was so outside my brain. I cannot understand in other way, but only by some political pressure, maybe to the court. I'm not a politician. And I don't know what happens behind the stage, but some pressure must be because it is a verdict outside of any legal logic.
Gotovina has been on trial since 2008. Along with 2 co-defendants, he was charged with multiple counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity related to the 1995 recapture of Croatia's Krajina region from Serbian forces. Dubbed Operation Storm, the 4-day offensive left hundreds dead and displaced over 150,000 ethnic Serbs from the region. That's what everyone agrees on. What's been in dispute during the 2.5-year trial was whether it was a tragic case of collateral damage, followed by the mass exodus of panicked civilians, or was it, as the prosecution argued, premeditated ethnic cleansing? Alan Teager, summing up for the prosecution, described how citizens soon realized they were in the path of the oncoming artillery fire.
What they didn't know was that the order to shell the towns had resulted from a meeting of the Supreme Commander of Croatian forces, Franjo Tuđman, and his top military advisors, including General Gotovina, about the importance of producing civilian flight through shelling. That objective succeeded. And President Tuđman was able to say shortly after, referring to the fact that most of the Serbs were gone, quote, "What we have created just now is a Croat state which will last for centuries," unquote.
Gotovina's defense team, however, argued that Serb authorities evacuated civilians from towns and villages in the Krajina region early in the offensive once they realized Croat forces were going to take the territory. In a phone interview before the verdict, defense attorney Luka Mitesic pointed to the testimony of former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, Peter Galbraith, as evidence that the Croatian military knew that they had to prioritize humane treatment of the civilian population.
He testified that, in fact, the U.S. had given the quote-unquote green light for the operation, and it is a big part of our case to say that he testified that there were 3 U.S. conditions given to Tuđman, in which he quickly, if UN peacekeepers were protected, and if Serb civilians were protected, that there would be no diplomatic consequences to Croatia. And what we see in the documents and the orders within the Croatian system is that everyone at every level is issuing orders that civilians need to be protected, including General Gotovina, which to us shows a consistent pattern that Tudjman was well aware that he and his country would have no diplomatic consequences because the United States would protect Croatia if Serb civilians were protected. The orders show that, in fact, that was the intention, was to implement the U.S. conditions and protect Serb civilians, and that's what was done.
Just how much U.S. officials knew about the details of Operation Storm is unclear, and the allegations of war crimes have led most involved to distance themselves from the offensive. Former President Bill Clinton says in his memoirs that he was rooting for the Croatians in the hope that a military defeat at Krajina would force Serbian leaders to the negotiating table in Dayton, Ohio. Less diplomatically, Robert Fraser, a former State Department official, wrote to a colleague saying, "We hired these guys to be our junkyard dogs. We need to try to control them, but this is no time to get squeamish about things." The defense also raised questions about the validity of Gotovina's indictment. Before Friday's hearing, defense counsel had said they were confident that the judges would make the right decision. But speaking outside the tribunal, Greg Kehoe for the defense angrily denounced the verdict.
"This decision, in our belief, is directly contrary to the laws and the facts that were presented in this case, and as if the court basically ignored everything that was presented by the Gotovina defense. The Gotovina defense put forth a very strong defense that General Gotova acted in accordance with military law and military tactics, and we will take that and we will examine this judgment and we will take it on appeal where we will be successful."
The trial might be over in The Hague, but for Serbs and Croats, the questions about Operation Storm still linger. Saša Obradović is the legal advisor for the Serbian embassy in The Hague.
"The Serbs from Krajina region in Croatia were the victims of the Operation Storm. They were forcibly removed from their homes. They were attacked while they were in the refugee columns. Their houses were set on fire. Their property were plundered. And all of these criminal actions were planned in advance, even by the top Croatian political and military leaders. That's Operation Storm in mind of the people in Serbia. However, the Operation Storm is still the national day, a holiday in Croatia. And that's a difference in the actually historical view to the events in Serbia and in Croatia."
One of Gotovina's co-defendants, Mladen Markač, was also found guilty on 8 charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Ivan Čermak was found not guilty on all charges and will be released immediately. Hermione G., FSRN, The Hague.
The House approved a resolution today in support of Representative Paul Ryan's budget. The Republicans' so-called path to prosperity has attracted fierce criticism, especially for its changes to the way Medicare and Medicaid benefits are distributed. Michael Lawson has more.
In the midst of tourists milling about the front of the Capitol Friday, a civic battle raged over what to do about the nation's debt. Democratic congressional leaders stood behind Josephine Ball Sivell, a senior from Baltimore who relies on Social Security and Medicare, as she objected to a provision of the Ryan Plan that critics say would leave seniors at the mercy of private insurers.
"Why do you think Congress passed Medicare in the first place? It's because insurance companies wouldn't cover us at a price that we could afford."
According to the Congressional Budget Office, under the Ryan Plan, Medicare would move to a system of support payments to Medicare beneficiaries to purchase private insurance beginning in 2022. The age of eligibility would also gradually increase to 67. Under Ryan's plan, recipients would pay 61 cents for each dollar of care, compared to less than half of that under traditional Medicare. Ryan contends that greater competition in the marketplace from more consumers would significantly lower costs, as he distinguished his plan on the House floor.
"It is a different philosophy. Should we have 15 unelected bureaucrats run Medicare, ration Medicare?
or should we allow 40 to 50 million seniors make the decision?
Ryan's budget plan also calls for the percentage of the economy dedicated to discretionary spending outside of defense to be cut in half by 2021 and raised with inflation each year after. Both the Progressive Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus released alternative budget proposals that failed in the House Friday. The Black Caucus budget would reduce the deficit by nearly $4 trillion over the next decade and reallocate $300 billion from defense spending to domestic programs. Representative John Lewis explained why he voted no on the Ryan proposal.
I do not like to see the massive cut in Medicare, Social Security, education. I think people want to see us as Democrats and want to see the president stand up and fight and be strong.
Ryan criticized both budget plans for their increase in domestic spending.
We've got it. We know where they are. More spending on everything but cut and gut defense and raise taxes a lot.
The Black Caucus budget plan would increase revenues by instituting a 5.4% surcharge on portions of income over $1 million and tax capital gains and dividends the same as income. While Ryan does recommend broadening the tax base by eliminating tax expenditures, under his plan, the top tax rate would be cut 10%, and no change would be made to capital gains and dividends. Lewis says the Ryan budget seeks to balance the budget with unnecessary sacrifices.
Well, the budget seek to be banners on the back for those who least can afford it, the most vulnerable segment of our society, the elderly, the disabled, the poor.
The Black Caucus budget garnered 103 votes. A defeated budget proposal by conservative Republicans to cut even more from the budget caused a shouting match on the House floor. 176 Democratic members voted present to force a debate between Republican leadership and the conservative wing. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
It's the final day for written comments on a new policy being considered by the Delaware River Basin Commission that would regulate gas drilling. Yesterday, environmentalists delivered about 30,000 public comments to the commission opposing natural gas drilling because of its impact on public health and the environment. And there's growing concern around the United States, from New Jersey and Pennsylvania to Wyoming and Texas. Ralph Kisberg is a founding member of Responsible Drilling Alliance in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where he says about two-thirds of the county is leased to gas drilling companies. He started his group a couple of years ago because he felt there wasn't enough information in the town about the impact of the drilling. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Daddy, and nice to hear from you.
Can you just clarify for us the different types of gas drilling and where the practice of fracking, which is also known as hydraulic fracturing, is used?
Right. Well, I think traditionally you think of gas exploration and drilling, looking for pockets of gas that you drill into. But those have obviously been taken in most of the surface land of the country, so they're long gone. So now you're looking for more different types of gas, and shale gas is gas that's been trapped in shale rock years ago when most of this area was under, millions of years ago when the area was under an ocean. So you've got rock with gas in it, but you have to break up that rock to get the gas to freely flow out at any significant quantities. So this is a fairly new technique to do this. It's actually only been really productive economically in the last 10-15 years, and started in Texas and has spread to other shale areas with shale deposits around the country.
Most of the drilling around Williamsport is using this newer fracking method?
Yes. I mean, there was some gas exploration years ago, but there never was significant amounts found in this part of Pennsylvania. There's a lot of the conventional gas in western Pennsylvania, but they're very small quantities, and I think we've had over 300,000 gas wells drilled in the state over the past 100 or more years, but never, this shale was known about for a long time, and in fact, a lot of landowners had very low payment leases with gas companies. They've had them for decades, but there was never any way to extract the gas from shale before.
So what sorts of environmental concerns does this process of extracting the gas raise?
Well, there's tons, but you can start with the fact that it uses a lot of water. We have a lot of water resources here, but, you know, we have droughts and we have worries like everybody else. We also have very different hydrology than a lot of the western states, where, especially Texas, where this gas drilling method was actually pioneered and got going on a big scale. We have lots of surface water that we're worried about contamination, and we have all kinds of different micro sort of aquifers, whereas Texas has maybe a dozen or so large aquifers, whereas if you're getting pollution mounting into those over time, it may take a long time before it shows up and health effects show up, whereas here, you know, we live on a sponge here. We have much more moisture, and that's probably the number one first concern is water supply, because the water that's used is tainted by chemicals that are added to it to go down during the process, and what's in the ground that really belongs way down there, including radioactive materials and all kinds of heavy metals that come up with what comes up out of the process. Air quality is another big factor that people are concerned about, and you know, land use, and there's just all kinds of ramifications, but you can start with air and water.
Tell us a bit more about some of the people you know in the area who are directly affected by those sorts of concerns.
Well, there's been a big problem in the northern part of Pennsylvania with what they call methane migration. So, you know, there's methane in the ground because there's methane's down there, and it is seeping out to some degree, perhaps over time. It's lighter than air, so it's going to rise up. But when you start drilling, and not even fracking exactly, but just drilling has caused a lot of migration of this methane. So it can show up in people's water wells. In at least two cases, it's shown up in people's homes to the extent where the houses have actually blown up. And luckily, no one was killed, but you can imagine the sort of terror that you have when in one little municipality you've had two houses blow up in the past year.
That must have caused quite a response. What sort of response from the authorities was there to houses blowing up?
Well, there's meetings, you know. What can we do about this? You know, the gas industry is only responsible for events that happen within 1,000 feet in this state of a well that's being drilled. So you have a lot of chance to say, no, it's not our fault. This methane was in the ground. We don't know where it came from. It's not. But you can trace these things and find out where they come from. And the only real recourse is going to be through the legal system, probably, to do this. I mean, it's not a huge amount considering they've drilled probably 2,600 wells, but we don't really have a firm count of how many water wells have been affected by the gas well drilling. But it's enough people who have found methane in their water and certain chemicals perhaps appearing. We're not sure because you don't know what to test for all the time. So there's a lot of questions, and we're just proceeding with it at kind of a breakneck speed that has people very upset and concerned.
Ralph Kisberg, founding member of Responsible Drilling Alliance in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. Take care.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.